Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Nicole Powell, a host on New Books in African American Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm excited to again be in conversation and sharing virtual space with Dr. Philip Butler. So to introduce Dr. Philip Butler, he's a term assistant professor of theology in Black Post-Human Artificial Intelligence Systems at iLife School of Theology in Denver, Colorado. He is also the founder of the Seeker Project, a distinctly Black conversational artificial intelligence with mental health capacities. His work primarily focuses on the intersection of neuroscience, technology, spirituality, and race. He's also the editor of the book that we'll be talking about today, Critical Black Futures, Speculative Theories and Explorations, a volume that explores Black futures from various vantage points. His first book project is entitled Black Transhuman Liberation Theology, and it imagines what might happen when Black people utilize technological advancements to enhance both Black spiritualities and Black bodies in the struggle of materializing liberating realities. Currently, he is working to construct a Black post-humanism that is both critical and speculative in nature. He is also building a distinctly Black artificial intelligence interface combining machine learning and psychotherapeutic systems. So thank you for joining me, Dr. Butler. Glad to have you again.
Yo, Nicole, thank you so much for agreeing to talk with me once more.
Of course.
And not being tired of me the first time. No. Just really excited to be here.
Yeah, me too. Thank you. So I want to start off with a question that you ask in the introduction, and that question is, what is a necessary event or context that precipitates Black innovation in the future? So in this contemporary moment that we're in the context of the pandemic, we see the intersection of disparities in healthcare and access. And I think a lot of people also who have lost loved ones have become even more aware of their mortality and their human state. So how does Critical Black Futures speak to this contemporary moment, and particularly the impact of the pandemic on Black communities?
I think that Critical Black Futures opens a portal, right? And not a portal in the sense of escape, but a portal in the sense of seeing potential possibilities. Because we recognize in this moment, there are various ways in which Black folks are in spaces where they're not in position to navigate or at the very least direct, right, their own trajectories of their lives, right? They're not in control of their futures broadly. And so I think that when we start looking at these kind of critical landscapes, it becomes not just a tool and not just a particular method for framing the future or imagining the future or, you know, placing ourselves on a path towards the future, but it allows us to engage in the type of critical discourse that can potentially be, and I think that's more of the hope of some of the aspects of this project. When we talk about engaging the critical nature, is that we hope that thinking critically will allow for the gaps between the space of being in historically marginalized and perpetually in space of disproportionalities. We can begin to build these bridges with clear struts that are not so much whimsical. And I know that sometimes it's important to have big dreams, but I think that there's a connecting piece that comes with like plotting and planning and strategizing. And I think that's where the critical aspects come into play.
Yeah. And I think something that you do in your work is you really center like plotting and thinking about the future as central to the critical discourse and as central to what progresses social change forward or has been central to a lot of Black critical thought. So why is speculation important for Black critical discourse? And are there lessons we can take from Black theologies, given their imaginative nature and critical modes of thought? Or do you see Black theology within this critical discourse?
Sure. No, I think that this speculative piece becomes important when we start talking about reverse engineering. You know, we see how other folks project into the future, and we see what potential realities they hope to happen, and even some of the dystopian realities that they imagine, given the potential for things to go awry, right, in our present realities. But nevertheless, I think if we look at what's been presented by other folks, what we say we want and what we are working towards, then it gives us the opportunity to kind of look at what is there, and then, you know, and then map it out backwards. Because if we want to get here, then there's certain things we have to do now, and there are certain things we got to do, right? And it doesn't necessarily have to be chronological in the sense that, like, by year 2025, this has to happen, you know, or by 2040 or 2075, these kind of things. I just think that if we're honest about the spaces that we want to cultivate and create and foster, then there is a real kind of walking the path backwards in order to make sure that the things that would constitute that moment are available and converging at that specific moment to allow for that moment to be the case. And I think that theologies are important here. And I think this is also where, and I'm trying to remember if we talked about this before, but this is where you have like this convergence between between pessimisms and theologies, because the pessimism allows you to look at kind of the darkest of the way in which the world is, or the darkest of things. But then the theologies allow for spaces of hope. And so I'm not gonna butcher the saying, but you know, when things are the darkest, then the light is around the corner, or you know, you have nowhere to go but up. But and so I think that's where we allow for this allow for a sense of disillusionment that comes with the critical eye, and then the theological allows for hope to come into the picture, and then allows for creativity and possibility to flourish.
Right. Yeah. And I think you were speaking a little bit about having, or there's a necessity to look forward in this moment to see where we want to go and to visualize mm-hmm. that. And I think it just reminds me of like disrupting time and disrupting like what's linear and leaning into that chaos. And I think your work also just speaks in the introduction more to like how leaning into that chaos, or leaning into, I think you use the word incomprehensibility, is just like is crucial to the Black tradition also. So yeah, finding power in that space. Yeah. And I know a lot of readers who will see the title Critical Black Futures will think about Afrofuturism. And you actually locate Critical Black Futures in part of the trajectory of Afrofuturism. But can you describe more about the differences between Afrofuturism and Critical Black Futures? And then also maybe a little bit about the language, like why not Afro futures? Why Black futures?
Right. No, I think that's fair. Right. And so, like, I think there's a few different spaces for us to engage in a launch pad or to begin to jump off from. I think when we look at Afrofuturism, as delineated by a few folks, Tosh Womack and a lot of the work that Renato Anderson has been doing as of late, especially when they've been working to, you know, unpack a lot of the earlier definitions of the term itself. So you have 1.0, which is like when people are kind of coming into Afrofuturism or something. Even I think Renato Anderson gives a timeline. I don't want to butcher it at the moment, but it's definitely definitely earlier in. I think it's I am butchering this timeline, so forgive me. And don't yell at me, Dr. Anderson. So look, right. But basically, we're talking about anywhere from like right before the Harlem Renaissance up until like the 90s, right? We start talking about the digital divide and whatnot. And then we have 2.0, which is this part where you have folks who are primarily Black beginning to engage in this work more broadly. Within that, it becomes this kind of a global Pan-African movement. And I think he also is outlining a 3.0, which becomes when Africans engage in Afrofuturistic work. And so along that trajectory that Renata Anderson outlines for us, right, you could locate critical Black futures within the 2.0 movement, mainly because, you know, if you go through the authors in this text, they're predominantly Black, and they are, in the American context, engaging in this kind of speculative and arts field. And so when we talk about any particular distinctions, we're also talking about the ways in which the critical nature, and so you could look at this in terms of critical theory, which has its kind of roots in, at least in traditional academic settings, kind of going back to like the Frankfurt School and stuff like that. But I think, you know, there are, we could argue that this, you know, it's the critical theory is more of a spirit or a disposition that has obviously, you know, lingered, you know, and existed much, it goes back further than that. But critical Black futures being different from Afro futures, futurism gives it a sense that it focuses specifically on Blackness in the I hate to say the word rabbit hole, but I don't hate to say the word rabbit hole, because we're talking about the abyss, and you've alluded to it even in kind of on the end of what you were saying before about this this chaos, this uncertainty, what's what I'm looking for? This jazz, right? This fluidity, this movement, right? And allows for this stochastic framing that is not, it's not random in the sense that it doesn't make sense. And even if it does make sense, it's not up to the people to decipher it, but it's the people that are in it to decipher it. And so it gives this clarity that comes out of the abyss. And so it's resting in and wrestling with the very thing that would be spoken against as being Black in this way.
Right. And just given that, I feel like locating it within the trajectory could be challenging, just given that it's not loyal to conceptions of time, and it leans into the abyss, as you've said, and into what's not comprehensible. So maybe like finding that location of when Black futures became part of the discourse would be really challenging, or locating it even before Afrofuturism.
And I think you're right in the sense that this kind of disloyalty to time is because it's not meant to be that way. And I think the critical nature is also, it's meant to create like these percussive moments of disillusionment. It's like we think that we've got something, and then we ask another question, and it separates us further from the thing we thought we had. And we may get settled, right, when, you know, as like the, you know, as a symbol, the immediate clash, and it comes back down, just kind of thinking about Moton's work. But then we ask another question, and it's like another gong or another symbol clash. And it just kind of takes us further and further from what we thought was our original center, and places in new spaces that, you know, that become home, but only for a moment.
Right. And just putting it in the academic sense of when it started becoming more part of the like academic discourse, would you locate it, as Dr. Sinatieri has in his chapter in your work, as part of Du Boisian thought, or earlier or sooner? Would you agree with that? Or where would you locate it as beginning in our like the academic discourse?
I mean, I think that what Dr. Sinatieri is doing is giving us, again, is giving us this kind of academic trajectory, which in some ways could definitely start with Du Bois, right? And just the trailblazing work that he had already done. But I think that the question becomes, so I'll say off the immediate, the academic space, sure. But, and I think that's also why it's critical Black futures. It's not the critical Black futures. And so like the critical Black futures also suggests like an A, critical Black right. futures, or critical Black futures in an open sense. Because right, and even in the text, we have folks, you know, who are engaged in the world of art, in the world of dance, and so on and so forth. And so this the origin or the starting point, I think, can easily be disrupted if we were to locate it in one space. But I think that what's helpful and what Dr. Sinatieri is doing, at least from a Du Boisian standpoint, is locating some of these earlier roots, because I think other folks would say that Du Bois' work definitely is not predated. If we want to go in a literary sense, there have been folks who have, within a literary space or even other just kind of the embodied spaces, who have done kind of these critical Black futuristic work prior to his, you know, kind of putting pen to pad.
And And you talked about a little bit about there not being like one singular Black future, but rather like critical Black futures rather than a Black future. And just wondering if that at all aligns with the reasoning behind doing the anthology format and wanting to choose a variety of different ways to reflect Black futures, a multiplicity of perspectives. Why was that important to you rather than just writing or theorizing yourself? Why was the anthology format more useful to you in this way?
No, I think that's an excellent question. So I think you're already kind of like hitting the nail on the head. It's like I have no ownership over critical Black futures in this way, right? And if the whole point in many cases is to create these layers and levels of disillusionment that comes from the critical aspects, then it is imperative that we have as many voices as possible from as many locations and positionalities of embodiment within the spectrum of Blackness, right, as possible in order to engage in this kind of this implosive, explosive, right, this divergent. And, you know, again, it's this disruptive force, because as long as anybody attempts to create this kind of singular approach to things, then there's immediately going to be somebody that comes along with it and does the disillusionment for them.
Yeah.
And so the hope is that, you know, that we open the door and welcome the disillusionment, not as a motive of as opposition, but as a motive of quantum embodiment, meaning that things can exist at the same space at the same time and also just be multitudinous, right, but also simultaneously be in just these multi-planar, multi-dimensional spaces, but still be real and still be, hey, not to use the word true, but to be tangible, and even to be intangible, but their intangibility to not be something that takes away from the credibility. And so I think it's just it's just an open invitation to be as disillusioning as potentially possible.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And I think you also in your idea of like including different mediums that reflect Black futures, I think you also reflect that multiplicity that you were talking about. There's pictures, art, there's text, there's academic work, there's like analysis of dance. There's just so many different mediums that people are using to reflect what they idealize around Black futures. And I think that reflects kind of your messaging around it being just like infinite or being multiple quantum ways of being all at once in the same time.
Exactly.
So how does this work diverge or build upon the themes of your previous work, Black Transhuman Liberation Theology?
That's a good question. I think it stays within the modes of technology or the technological. Even if the technology is the body, I think there's ways in which we look at ourselves as the very thing that we use to communicate, and we use ourselves as are the extenders of our own consciousness, as you know, whenever they're in conversation with somebody else's extension of their consciousness. And so the technological, I think, is a very very real aspect of it. And I think there's also, again, we talk about freedom or these liberative kind of themes or motifs that exist throughout. while I am one to actively and intentionally question anything that promotes itself to be freeing or liberating, I still think it's a worthwhile thing or concept to sit with, because even as our understandings of these terms shift, we still at the very least become clearer about the ways in which we attempt to move toward them, individually, collectively, so on and so forth. And then, you know, this kind of spiritual aspect of it, because I think I am a proponent of the idea that that our epistemologies are our spiritualities. And so regardless of whatever sits in the seat of God in your framing, it becomes a thing that you center your world around, and the things and your understandings of love and community and people and yourself, you know, or the universe or so on and so forth. Like the way that you understand these terms sets up the way in which you relate to, you know, yourself, to other people, to nature, so on and so forth. And so these become your spiritualities, which is another reason why I think the framing of the criticality becomes so important, because I think that in many cases, I would argue that one's spirituality is often an opaque thing that only becomes clearer through critical introspection. And I think that that's something that I highlighted in my previous work, and it's something I think that I'll continue for at least for the time being. And so when we talk about asking people to be critical of the very thing that they say they identify as or understand about themselves, we're also asking them to engage in a particular ritual and embark on a journey that allows for them to either throw away something that they thought they held dear or come closer to it and then have a reason why. That allows for a strengthening of that understanding of themselves and the things that they relate to.
Wow. When you're speaking just now, I'm thinking so much about imagination and the emphasis on imagination in theology and, as you said, in critical discourse. And I'm thinking also about like your last chapter, New Hampton, and how New Hampton is like an ideal, like new version of Wakanda, or like American version of Wakanda. But the difference is that New Hampton has been colonized, or it has been touched, or it's not untouched by colonization, or like outside influences. And I'm wondering, this is kind of a really deep question, but I'd be curious about your thoughts on like, how can people who are oppressed or who have been colonized, are their imaginations decolonized, or do you believe that that can be separate from someone's imagination? Someone who is a colonized person, do you believe that their imagination can be free of the colonization, or is that a decolonial space?
I think the act of decolonizing is something that will probably go on into infinity in many cases, but I also think that there has to be on some level a willingness to determine what is yours and what is not yours, or meaning that, like, when we talk about something as simple as like empiricism, right, or science or something like that, like these things that seem to be aspects of like of coloniality or things that come from coloniality, where people, indigenous peoples, and folks who you know, from different modes of diasporic spaces, had their own sciences, right, and their own ways of understanding that may be oppositional, but in some ways are very much alike. And so the question becomes like, what do we get to determine is solely owned by the colonizer, especially if the act of colonizing is primarily expansion and absorption. And if expansion and absorption is a thing where people no longer cite where they get their ideas from and somehow get credit for it, for other people's stuff, then it's really, it becomes this gray space where it seems like people don't have anything except for what has been given to them by people who have stolen everything. And so when we talk about this decolonizing. Yeah, right. And so like when we're talking about like this, like decolonized imagination, I just wonder, like, what is it that you want? And then what is it that you are going to be clear about is yours, stemming from where you came from, or recognizing that even in the midst of everything here, this is something that you're willing to hold on to, after again, engaging in the act of disillusionment. All right. And I guess I'm also just, I guess I'm also just curious about the ways in which we begin to and begin to do the work of anti-colonialism, and in the sense that we are working to demarcate our own space and unlink ourselves from coloniality while simultaneously creating barriers or barricades or boundaries at the very least that allow for us to maintain the space that we are reclaiming or reconciling within ourselves, let alone our communities and the peoples that we are connected to and care about most. And so I say all that to say again, like, you know, what is it that you are choosing to stay with, and what is it that you are, how is that affecting the ways in which you choose to, you know, move freely about the world? I hope that makes sense.
That does make sense. I mean, I think it's challenging to differentiate, or it's challenging for a colonized subject to differentiate, like, or yeah, and it's a really important question to ask, like, what do you want to claim as your own? What do you want to claim as indigenous to yourself? Or maybe even if it's something syncretic that was formed as a result of colonial influence, do you still want to claim that? It's just a really important question to ask when thinking about, like, the process of decolonization. What do you want to claim? And it's a challenging question.
No, it is.
Yeah.
It is. I just want to add this one thing because it is a challenge. Because you talk about this kind of dissipation. It's like, we can't go back. Yeah. Right. And then, you know, when we talk about decolonization, right, there's a 2018 essay about romanticizing the decolonial subject. And it's like we don't even know enough about those folks to really create this relationship in the way we'd like to. And so it's like, you know, again, so then what do we project forward into the future? You know, what subjects do we want to be, or what subjects do we want to create, you know, through our families and through our communities? You know, what practices do we want to take from this space and the one that we look fondly upon, that we have, you know, less of a tangible, you know, relationship with? And then how do we turn these new rituals into, you know, into spaces that are sacred, that uphold, you know, the places that we wish we had been able to be in contact with, and the people that we are being in contact with and hoping to, you know, set a realm for, you know, in the future.
Yeah. And does this also relate to why you chose New Hampton to be uncolonized? I mean, why you chose New Hampton to be colonized or touched by colonization or have been touched? Is that why, just like that claiming of not totally disavowing it, but claiming some things and asking yourself, what things can you claim or can you locate in your own lineage and that you want to incorporate into what becomes after colonialism?
I think so. New Hampton is a place that we can get to from here, right? And if it is a place that we can get to from here, then it would have been touched at one point. Like, say it was a county in California, right? Or it was a municipality, you know, in the middle of, you know, Wyoming or something at one point. That means that, you know, it had already been touched. It had already been in communication with, you know, imperial powers at one point. And then, you know, the work of attempting to create these militarized, you know, community-owned spaces, yeah, that somehow are able to engage in kind of this equitable distribution amongst Black folks in this city, right? It recognizes what disparity is, right? So it's come from a place that knew what disparity was. It's come from a knowledge of what, you know, of what Tulsa, what happened in Tulsa among the other, you know, Black massacres in the United States, you know. And so and this is why it has armed itself and engages in self-determination the way it does. You know, it recognizes that spirituality and community are important. And this is why, you know, everything is done the way it is, or the way that the city, you know, is alive in and of itself, given the, you know, the AI that helps to run it. And, you know, the ways in which it understands itself and functions is the result of, right, a, a, an acknowledgement of history, given the history that we, you know, at this present moment, like you and I having this conversation, are aware of and unaware of. So I think it's an attempt to see a viable space that we could get to from this moment that we are, or when people listen to this, whenever that is.
Yes, and I think that's really powerful, honestly, and that's creating hope by starting where we are in this exact moment. Because I do think when we watch something that has never been colonized or has never been touched, it's imaginative in a way that can be idealistic and maybe feel like we can't reach that point because that's not where we are and that's not our history. But starting at where we are does create hope. It says, like, here's where we are and here's where we need to be, or here's where we can be. So starting off with something that's more familiar, people's actual reality, is creating hope and creating solutions. So
I hope so.
That's great. Yes. Well, thank you, Dr. Butler. I want to end on the hopeful note, and I really appreciate you for taking time to speak with me today. Thank you.
Nah, this is dope. Yo. I always love your questions, and just being able to sit down and talk with you, it's a pleasure, and it's an honor. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.